Hello, everyone. Welcome to Liberating the Queen. I am Susie Mosco. It is the 15th of February, 2018. This podcast, we are talking about the intelligent, spiritual, and charismatic Ida B. Wells. She is one of the greatest leaders in early civil rights movements in the United States. She is a fierce guardian of truth, justice, and the power of the press. Get comfortable. This is a woman who provokes thought and conversation and will keep you on your toes. Get ready to meet Ida Bell Wells. Ida was born in Holly Springs, Mississippi, July 16, 1862. She was the first child of Lizzie and James. She was born into slavery during the Civil War. Now, her parents were really raised on opposite ends of the spectrum as a life of a slave. Her mother was taken away from her family at a very young age. She was beaten by slave owners and had survived much hardship. When the family was free, her mother attended school with her children until she was able to read the Bible. She did receive a perfect attendance award one year. She was very eager to learn, but more wanted to teach her kids the importance of family and the importance of having a strong relationship with God. Her father, on the other hand, was half white and an only child. So his father gave him more opportunities than an average black man at that time. James was involved with the Freedom Aid Society and helped start Shaw University, a school for newly freed slaves. Now it's called Rust College. He served on the first board of trustees. Daily, he would ask Ida to read the paper, which would fuel a large passion for her in later life. Her parents were both active politically and understood the importance of keeping their children well-educated but also spiritually guided. Unfortunately, Ida took a trip to go visit her Aunt Peggy on a farm, and during that time, yellow fever had really struck the Mississippi Delta. Now, her father and mother were trying to really be a part of the community and help with the yellow fever epidemic, but unfortunately, they had succumbed to the fever. Ida had received a message while on the farm that her parents had passed away and she needed to get back home. When she arrived back home, many people went to the Wells house to tell them that they were willing to take a sibling or two siblings. Her father was a Mason. And when you have a Mason as a father, and I'm assuming this is how it is today, but there's a whole community around who's really, really ready to step in and take care of widows and orphans. But Ida, at the age of 16, and understanding and really absorbing everything her mother said, understood the importance of keeping her family together and understood the hardship that her mother faced being split apart from her family. She wouldn't allow it. She wanted her family to stay together, and she feared her parents would roll over in their graves. She told everyone she would take care of it. Now, she did ask them for a favor in helping her secure a job. She then went to a school administrator and convinced them that she was 18 and became a teacher. Now, during this time, she had to commute, essentially, to work, and she would stay with other family friends. She was working every day during the week. She received about $25 a month as a teacher, and then on the weekends, she would come home and care for her four other siblings, one of them who was confined to a wheelchair, and she would sew on the weekends and do other odd jobs just to make sure that everything was on the up and up. It was during the 1880s she moved to Memphis and continued to teach. Many people at that time were moving into Memphis. When Ida arrived, over half the population was black. But there was one fateful train ride from Memphis to Nashville in May 1888. Wells reached a personal turning point. Having bought a first-class train ticket to Nashville, a white man could not find a seat on the train. It was at that time a conductor came to Ida and demanded that she move to the train car designated for black passengers. Well, she was outraged. The train crew ordered her to move to the car with African Americans. Here is how Ida recounted the event. Quote, "I refused. I proposed to stay. The conductor tried to drag me out of my seat, but the moment he caught hold of my arm, I fastened my teeth in the back of his hand. I had braced my feet against the seat in front and was holding to the back. As he had already been badly bitten, he didn't try it again by himself. He went forward and got the bagman and another man, and they succeeded in dragging me out." end quote. Ida later sued the railroad and won $500 in a Tennessee circuit court. Unfortunately, the Tennessee Supreme Court found in favor of the railroad. In 1897, the Supreme Court established the legal doctrine of separate but equal, which essentially codified segregation across the U.S. Now, at this point, Ida is still teaching. She slowly starts to publish articles in her church newspaper. She understood the power of the news. As we stated earlier in the podcast, her father had her read it to him every day. This was something that held not only a lot of prestige to Ida, but also a lot of power in being able to communicate a message. Her passion continued to grow, to have her voice be heard, and so did her love for journalism. While working as a journalist and publisher, Wells held a position as a teacher in a segregated public school in Memphis. She became a vocal critic of the condition of Black-only schools in the city. In 1891, she was fired from her job for these attacks. She stopped teaching as a profession and became the editor of the Memphis Free Speech and Headlight. Later on, she would become the owner of the Free Speech. Ida did not isolate herself to just one cause or one issue. She wrote on a variety of different topics that hit not only the people of Memphis, but really our nation. She rapidly became a very prominent journalist. She focused on gaining factual information to support a point of view or a different way of thinking. She was very outspoken and lively in conversations. It wasn't until Ida was personally confronted with another injustice that her drive for change grew stronger. In 1889, Thomas Moss, a friend of Wells, opened the People's Grocery. This was in the quote-unquote Curve, a Black neighborhood just outside of Memphis city limits. It did well and competed with a white-owned grocery store across the street. Their new business started to draw customers away from the white-owned store in the neighborhood, and the white store owners and supporters clashed with the men who had opened the People's Grocery on a few occasions. One night in particular, Moss and others guarded their store against an attack and ended up shooting several of the white vandals. They were immediately arrested and brought to jail, but they didn't have a chance to defend themselves from the charges. A lynch mob took them from their cells and murdered them. Since Wells knew these men and was good friends in particular with Moss, she couldn't understand why these men, who did everything in the world that said Blacks should do, they were still lynched. The lynchings created numerous unanswered questions for Wells, since they were contrary to the accepted belief that lynchings were punishment for rape. Wells became one of the first people to bring insight into the broader topic of American lynching. There was a clear correlation of economic status and lynching to ensure Negro statuses could not grow higher than the allotted within that city limit. Wells wrote articles decrying the lynching of her friend and the wrongful deaths of other African Americans. Putting her own life at risk, she spent 2 months traveling in the South, gathering information on other lynching incidents. She made an effort to collect as much data as possible, white newspapers, pictures, and testimonials. She used names and dates to put together comprehensive editorials that couldn't go ignored. One of the editorials seemed to push some of the city whites over the edge. A mob stormed the office of her newspaper, destroying all of her equipment. Fortunately, Wells had been traveling to New York City at the time. In Ida's words, quote, "The mob took possession of the People's Grocery Company, helping themselves to food and drink, and destroyed what they could not eat or steal. The creditors had the place closed, and a few days later, what remained of the stock was sold at an auction. Thus, with the aid of the city and county authorities and daily papers, the white grocer had indeed put an end to this rival Negro grocer, as well as to his business." End quote. According to Wells, the logic of lynching was not criminal. It was economic. Lynching and mob violence were tactics of economic subordination used to protect white economy power and to ensure a captive black labor force. Understanding lynching as a tool of state economic repression, Walls encouraged black residents of Memphis to leave, taking with them their labor and capital. The departure of many African-American residents had profound impact on the economics of Memphis. After 6 weeks of lagging revenue, the local white-owned railway company approached Wells to ask for her support to get blacks to ride streetcars again. In the following exchange with the railway company, Wells argues that 19th century capitalism depended on racial violence. In a conversation with Ida and a streetcar company that took place 6 weeks after the lynchings, the streetcar company felt they had nothing to do with the lynchings and were being unfairly associated with the event. Ida has a conversation with them, and at the end of the conversation, she states, quote, "We have learned that every white man of any standing in town knew of the plan and consented of the lynching of our boys," end quote. Many blacks left. She understood the economic impact to black-owned businesses. Why stay somewhere if they aren't going to protect our homes or our businesses? She encouraged people to go to Kansas or Oklahoma. Ida knew that she could affect change through the pocketbooks of white men. In 1892, she was warned that she would be killed if she ever returned to Memphis. She would not return to the South for 30 years. This is where we see Ida really move into a strategy of organizing and being action-based. Despite threats on her life in Memphis due to her activism and journalism, Wells was convinced that a lot of power lay in the media and moved to New York, where she continued writing. This time for T. Thomas, Fortune's New York Age, an African-American weekly newspaper with a substantial white following. For her first article, Wells drew on the full extent of her material collected from her lynching investigations. On June 25th, 1892, it became the first published exposé of a lynching in the United States. Wells reported on facts she gathered, giving names, dates, and places of many lynchings for the accused crime of rape. The New York Age placed the article on its front page, printed 10,000 copies, and distributed them across the country. Wells' facts made clear lynching was not a response to rape or a greater level of criminality among African Americans. Lynching, she determined, was an excuse to get rid of Negroes who were acquiring wealth and property. Also in 1892, this is when Ida Wells publishes Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases. She publishes this in a pamphlet format. This is something that she uses to hand out at different speaking events, at different rallies. Not long afterwards, in 1895, Wells published a more ambitious project, The Red Record. Both of these pamphlets I recommend reading, and we'll be providing links along with the blog post so you can find them. They are very graphic in nature, but really you see the point that she is trying to make and really start developing anti-lynching laws. One quote in particular stands out, quote, "If indeed the pen is mightier than the sword, the time has come, as never before, that the wielders of the pen, belonging to the race which is so tortured and outraged, should take serious, thoughtful, and purposeful action," end quote. This is something that is not only relevant to our time today, but also very much a rally cry in her time. If you're not listening, if you're not paying attention, you're part of the problem. And I think this is something that within her history of having this love for the newspaper and having a voice and really wanting to be heard is a really powerful rally cry during this time. Wells also made a very thought-provoking suggestion in the whole lynching and rape, which really talks about white women volunteering themselves to black men. At this time, this was an improbable thought, and the response to this claim, they were infuriating to the white press. Many people went on the attack of this taboo subject, insisting that every time a black man was with a white woman, it was rape. This is part of her dialogue that talks about where black men are being accused of rape, but they may not actually be committing rape. Since a lot of these men didn't have a trial, they went right to being lynched, it's hard to really know what the situation was. But either way, this conversation was something that wasn't even broached. And she was the first one really to bring light and to force the conversation to say that there are white women who are dating black men and they're consenting to it. While living in New York, she led the first anti-lynching campaign. This would be a major movement for the NAACP. And Ida was one of two women who signed the call for formation of the NAACP. In 1893, Wells lectured abroad to drum up support for her cause among reform-minded whites. Upset by the ban of African-American exhibitors at the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition, Wells penned and circulated a pamphlet entitled "The Reason Why the Colored American is Represented in the World's Columbian Exposition," really driving home the point that the strong American economy and industry was built on the backs of slaves. There would be no Columbian Exposition without blacks in America. Wells again makes a connection that with this new black freedom requires a new system of intimidation in America. White men no longer valued the slave body to produce work, as the free man could be killed and intimidated by death, especially if they threaten white economic status. 1894, Wells gathered information that attributed to 197 persons that were put to death by mobs and were given no opportunities to make a lawful defense. She then took her campaign to England, again, understanding the economic impact at a global level, not to do business with people who would support such treatment of human lives. She had let the nation know what was happening, and it was time to let the world know. Her style was very militant, very pragmatic, fact-based. She joined the suffrage movement as well, fighting for women and for blacks. As she matures, you see what a threat she becomes to her causes and her convictions. She's very steady and strong in her thoughts. And even at times in the civil rights movement, she is criticized for being a woman. She still shows up and goes to the meetings and still participates and has a strong voice and demands to sit at the table. And in the women's movement, she is sometimes repressed for being black. She carries on and finds other solutions, like starting groups particularly for black women. There is an anecdote in some of the research that we did that talks about an altercation with Susan B. Anthony, where right after she was married, Susan B. Anthony was very upset that she was married. She felt like the dual responsibility couldn't happen. And Ida B. Wells felt very strongly that she could maintain a family and still be part of the conversation and still be able to have thoughts. And that was an important part of the women's movement. So there are a lot of really great stories and a lot of really great anecdotes with Ida and all of these really great leaders that we know today. In 1898, Wells continues to not shy from conversation, brings her anti-lynching campaign to the White House, leading a protest in Washington, D.C., and calling for William McKinley to make reforms. She, upon meeting him, demands reforms and demands change within America. In 1917, she was visited by the Secret Service and told it was treason for her to hand out buttons defending black men who were punished for fighting for equal rights in the armed forces. In 1919, she returns to the South, a woman in her 60s. She visits a group of men who were imprisoned from rioting or what is called the Flight of the Farms, where families of color were trying to really establish farming and establish their community. Wells prepared other pamphlets, and the men were freed shortly after her pamphlet and campaign had started. The press became a powerful tool for Wells and for the movement. Her fear is that racial history is based only from the perspective of those who participated and limited to those who report it. She worries that the future of Black men won't get to see the truth or prosperity of Black economy, but their history will be built on fear of being lynched or being branded as a race that simply cannot prosper. In the research that we were able to do, there is a lot of information on Ida B. Wells and a lot of things that she wrote. And I'll provide everything in the blog that corresponds with this podcast. I encourage everyone to take a look and read about Ida B. Wells. You can visit the Ida B. Wells Museum. This is the house where she was born. And it is a dedicated museum that you can go into. There is also the house in Chicago on Martin Luther King Drive that she lived in. This is a National Historic Landmark, but you cannot go inside. It is a private residence. In 1991, her daughter published her unfinished biography, Crusade for Justice. She hadn't finished it. She was literally mid-sentence before her life was taken. She fought for many causes. She gave direct and constructive criticism and was really someone who drove a lot of passion for the truth and a lot of passion for justice. She's someone we don't hear a lot about, but during that time was a very prominent figure. And I hope everyone takes the time to read one of her journals or read one of the pamphlets and really take a moment to look into some of the great dialogue that she created, which are foundational to the civil rights movement and foundational to some ways we live today. All right, everyone. Thank you for joining me today as we learned about Ida B. Wells. Again, citations and articles, everything will be along in the blog companion of this podcast. Something we're trying new this month is we are taking sponsors for the March episode. So if you would like to advertise with us, please send an email to dan@liberatingthequeen.com for requests on how to sponsor and where you can fit into our show. Again, I encourage everyone to take a look at any hidden figures they can find and enjoy your month of February.